This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Whew. It's nice to be back at Jikoji. It's been about 25 years that I have been coming here. On and off, mostly on. And it's always wonderful to notice the changes over the years. Jikoji is becoming more and more elegant. When I first arrived, it was pretty bohemian. I'm being diplomatic. it still retains some of that bohemian flavor. Some things that don't seem ever to change is when I arrive, I usually see a set of seed flats on the arm of a chair, with lots of kale seedlings protected by this misshapen piece of wire mesh. So that's something I can pretty much count on. The kitchen is always reorganized. Things are always moved around each year. There are always piles of rocks waiting to find their perfect location, and lots of blue masking tape all over the place. So these are anchors that I can count on when I return to Jikoji. It truly is I sometimes think there are four jewels: the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and Jikoji. It really, in a way, the Zendo is a fourth jewel, our practice place. It's very, very important. And Jikoji is a jewel, and it continues to be polished and become more and more radiant while still having its sort of, it's like a Rodin's sculpture, which is all beautiful and smooth on the top, but you can see where it comes from. You can see the rough rock. So that's one of the charms of Jikoji, that it has this beautiful melding of elegance and sort of wabi-sabi, this sort of ragged edges.
What? Chivalry.
Yes, chivalry. Yeah. So 25 years ago, I came up from Santa Cruz, where my daughter was living at the time, and entered this place. I came in the evening, and the Zendo was dark and cold. That's another thing I can kind of count on. There's always going to be some cold spots at Jikoji. And it was really cold. They didn't have this wonderful heating system. And I sat down in the Zendo. All the floors were not bamboo, beautiful bamboo. They were all mats of like that, all laid out on the floor. And the Zendo was empty. And I sat down to meditate and was really cold. But I hung out, and about 20 minutes into my meditation, and I could feel myself kind of shivering, and about 20 minutes into my meditation, I felt a warm blanket covering my shoulders. You probably don't remember this. This is a long time ago. And I was just overwhelmed with what felt like a gesture of compassion. That this just blanket appeared over my shoulders. And I continued to sit, and I was aware that there was somebody else in the zendo this blanket didn't just kind of come down from the skies and land on my shoulders. Someone put it there. And he was the one who did that. He was the only one in the zendo. Of course, these are things students remember. Teachers, they forget a lot of these sort of memorable moments for their students. That was a profound beginning for me of this, for this path. I had already been practicing for a number of years, but that marked oddly, that small gesture marked the beginning of a relationship with Mike as my teacher. And it's been a long journey. When that blanket was first placed over my shoulders, I made the mistake of taking it personally to begin with. It seemed like that it established some kind of connection that was strictly on a personal level with Mike. And for a number of years, I sat with that feeling of personal involvement. And only recently, and by recently I mean the past 10 years, I have come to understand that that blanket was this. That blanket was this rakusu, the black robe of priesthood, which I am not wearing today, and perhaps soon a brown robe. That blanket was a symbol, was a gesture of being wrapped in the warmth and the comfort and the depth of Buddha's Dharma. And my journey on this path has been marked by that continual rewrapping of the package, rewrapping of the package again and again and again in the warmth of that teaching, of those teachings. And Mike was transmitting that through this embrace of this warmth of teaching to me. So many of my students have asked me, and I've introduced this idea of a pathway, a journey. And I've been asked, well, Meido, how do I know that I'm progressing? How do I know that things are unfolding as they should unfold along this way? And I've been considering that because I'm at a point in my own journey, which is a new stage for me. It's we call the brown robe stage. I know it's supposed to be private, and you can look this up on Google, so it isn't really private. You can discover exactly what transmission and what having a brown robe is all about. You might say it's intimate. It's very intimate, but it is not private because there's nothing that's private. Nothing is private. Everything we are and do is open and vast and interconnected with everything else. So there's no privacy, really, ultimately. So I want to share some of the, you could say, milestones of my movement along this path. And, of course, people want to know, am I progressing? And, of course, in the Heart Sutra, we learn that there is nothing to attain. Attainment, too, is emptiness. But we do move. We do move along this path. And some of the milestones for me along this path, I'm going to single out three. There are probably many more. The first one was with my very first teacher prior to having met Mike. Her name was Diane Banaj. She was a very accomplished, high-ranking person in the Soto Zen church, you might say. She's in Pennsylvania, where I live. And she knew me as a very ambitious woman. And I am very ambitious. I come from a very poor family, and I was determined to achieve status and prestige, and I went about doing that with one pointed mind. I was going to accomplish a lot in my life. And I was pretty determined, and I was able to use this mind to become a successful academic. So she knew me as as one of these women who was powerful and strong and was on top of it. And then when I ordained as a priest, I sewed my okesa in the San Francisco Zen Center. It took me 14 days. I just plowed through it, as I did most things.
That's a record, by the way.
Yeah, I have a reputation now. It's like the fish story. Some people, you sewed your robe in 7 days? No, it was 14 days, but it keeps getting shorter and shorter. And, sure.
Two or three years.
Yeah. So I just plowed through it. And I got back to Pennsylvania, and here was my okesa, and I had achieved this, and I had a sangha and a meditation hall, and I went to see Diane, and I said, Diane, I have this okesa and I have a zagu, but I haven't the foggiest idea of what I'm supposed to do. And she said, finally. So this sense of not having the foggiest idea of what I'm supposed to do was a very important moment for me. I really had I don't know mind. I just don't know. The second milestone along this way was a couple of years ago when I came back to Jikoji, and I had been through a number of personal traumas everything that I could have imagined to go wrong in my life did. And I had never experienced the level of depression and anxiety and suicidal thinking, really severe. Lots of things went wrong. Showed up at Jokoji and went for Dokusan and said, you know, and Mike says, how are you doing? I said, you know, I am a hopeless mess. I am a hopeless mess. And he said, I am so glad to hear this. I have been waiting for this moment. I don't know, mind. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm a hopeless mess. Another milestone along the way. Really important. Number three. Just a couple of days ago, I am practicing tea with my mentor, Jiro. And he sets up the tea space in a way that I had never experienced before. I had exactly what it is, how I set it up, where I'm going to set all the utensils, and exactly I had it down. And he completely rearranged it. And I said, let's start serving tea. And I said, wait, I'm completely, totally disoriented. And he said, good. Remember that. Okay, so when you don't know what you're doing, when you are a hopeless mess, and when you're totally disoriented, you're ready for transmission. You're ready to take the next step. You know you've gotten somewhere. So this is a path. You could say it's a path of remembering that you aren't who you think you are. That I sometimes speak of all of this construction that we do, sometimes considered ego construction. I sometimes think of that as putting post-its all over your body, like mother, friend, teacher, lover, whatever your artist, cook, they're all plastered all over you. And they're wonderful. They kind of flap around in the wind. But then we start identifying. We start thinking these are like really permanent things. Like, they're not like blue masking tape that we can just peel off. That's who we are. And so we spend a lot of our lives discovering, particularly when we're reduced to I don't know, I'm hopeless, and I'm completely disoriented, we discover that these things are completely useless. That they just kind of fly off, and we are, as we had an ordination here, and Mike talked about Mark Adams becoming a baby again. we become innocent, open, pure, undefiled, who we really are. And we spend, at least I've spent most of my adult life remembering that, remembering that by being forced, actually, by the circumstance of life to be forced to remember that. So this reminds me of a little story of a little girl, 6 or 7 years old, whose mom would leave every morning to go teach at a university. And the little girl wanted to know where her mom was going every day. And she asked, where are you packing up all your stuff and you're leaving and where are you going? She says, well, I go to the university to teach people art, to teach them how to draw, how to paint, how to make sculpture, all those things. She says, you mean they forgot? This is very much... You mean you forgot? You forgot who you really are? And of course, when you hear of enlightenment stories, it's often said, oh, it was right there. There's nothing special. It was just right there all the time. How did I miss it? How did I forget this? So this pathway, at least again, I'm just sharing my own personal experience. You have yours. Is a path of awakening to who we really are. And it's a realization. It's like, oh, I realize something. And the process of realization, awakening, enlightenment, is at the very same time a process of becoming real. Now, in preparing this talk, I managed to find this very esoteric Buddhist text that illustrates and addresses this process of realization. And I dug it out of my library and brought it here today to share with you. And it's called The Velveteen Rabbit. Since we're in the process of becoming babies, I think I've got stalled at the toddler stage here with The Velveteen Rabbit. Wonderful story, and I also recommend another esoteric Buddhist text by Oscar Wilde entitled The Happy Prince, which is all about deep, deep story about gratitude. Anyway, this is about becoming real. And the Velveteen Rabbit is talking to the skin horse. This is, takes place in a nursery. How many of you know about the Velveteen? And the wisest being in the nursery is the skin horse, and the Velveteen Rabbit is talking to the skin horse and asking the skin horse, "What is real?" asked the rabbit one day. "Does it mean having things that buzz inside you and a stick-out handle?" "Real isn't how you're made," said the skin horse. "It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real." "Does it hurt?" "Sometimes," for he was always truthful. "When you are real, you don't mind being hurt." "Does it happen all at once, like being wound up, or bit by bit?" "It doesn't happen all at once. You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't happen often to people who break easily, or who have sharp edges, or who have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off, and your eyes drop out, and you get loose in the joints, and very shabby." Remember those three milestones. The rabbit sighed. He thought it would be a long time before this magic called real happened to him. He longed to become real, to know what it felt like. And yet the idea of growing shabby and losing his eyes and whiskers was rather sad. He wished that he could become it without these uncomfortable things happening to him. Oh yes, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have to go through the hell realms? Wouldn't that be lovely? But that isn't this pathway. You don't have to wait until you're my age and gone through the hell realms. You can become real right now.
I just want to acknowledge that that was really great.
Question? Quite common?
I love that story. Like, I have always loved that book. So it was cool that you pulled it out. But what I liked about this reading of it is I always thought of that as like loving a person. You know, like the idea that love, like just the way the experience of like loving a person changes your life. But I was questioning, like, well, is it actually loving that person, or what enables you to like love that person, like that waking up process, like your true nature, that is what makes you real, and that what you would call love, rather than like this more like self-sacrificial personal idea of just this deep affection and desire to like protect this other person. So I liked the connection between the idea of love making you real and the process of growing the Dharma, or just growing in our awakeness and our like freedom from ego identification.
So. Yeah, thank you for that. We don't hear a lot about love in our practice. It's usually more about compassion. That's the feeling of feeling with someone or others. But I think love is a really significant state of being. It's a state of the heart. And I think that one of the things that one travels along this path, that sense of love begins to expand or deepen. And I understand that when Buddha saw the morning star and his words were, "All beings have Buddha nature," for me that was an expression of love. It was that recognition that all things are beautiful and perfect just as they are. And that was from the heart. That wasn't a rational statement. All things have Buddha nature. So that as you deepen your practice and come to a deeper experience of the world, as I think Buddha did, your sense of others, all beings, is this incredible affection and passion and love for all things. And you could say the expression of love is to see the Buddha nature beyond just the personal aspects of personality and body form or all the things that we sort of associate with personal love. When you see someone's true nature or something's true nature, that feeling of love just naturally emerges because you see the perfection of everything, of every single thing. So that feeling is just completely natural. I can remember coming into the Zendo or walking. I have a forest Zendo, and we have a meditation trail that goes into the woods. And just feeling as I'm walking along that trail with the Sangha in Pennsylvania, this just overwhelming feeling of love for everything around. And that single gesture, and there are all kinds of single gestures that awaken that opening of the heart. It can be a blanket over your shoulders. Many years ago, Juro sent me a little vase, a hanging vase from Japan, because I had admired a tea bowl that he had used in a tea service. And this vase appeared in the mail from Japan, and it was just, I hardly even knew Juro at the time. So that just kind of broke my heart open. All these small gestures, but they lead into a deep place. I don't know, I'm just trying to respond to your question. I hope it was useful in some way.
Yes. Okay. Definitely agree with all that. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I feel like lots of the ways that we're nudged in life is towards like doing the things that make us more comfortable. And so I always really appreciate kind of the nudges towards embracing the discomfort. I'm curious to hear, like, for the ways that you do have positive associations with the discomfort, like, how do you think about it? Is the discomfort itself good, or is it getting you towards somewhere else? How do you think about that, kind of most abstractly?
Well, my practice is, good question. My practice is less to think about it, not to develop a lot of stories around it, because that's, we often say that's putting another head on the head you already have. And that's kind of creating more suffering, to do a lot of thinking about it. So to practice with it, to at least to have the orientation to it that, welcome, sort of like, good, welcome, this is a point of practice for me. I'm going to be with this. So it's a welcoming, it's a feeling of welcome, because this gives me an opportunity to engage my practice. And that all of these you don't really grow except with push. we'd like to be like the Velveteen Rabbit. We just like to have all this just perfectly laid out for us and become real without all that pushback. And we could ask, why me? Why? There's no answer to that. This is just the way it is. And this is what it means to be human. And so the door opens and, oh, I thought I was done with you. I thought I was done with that. But okay, welcome back in. I have an opportunity to. So it's an attitude of really of self-compassion. Of, yeah, this is part of me, and I'm going to be with it. I'm just going to be with it and see. Everything is a roshi, everything is a sensei, everything is a teacher, and it's all coming from you. So this is your Buddha nature speaking to you and saying, oh, you've got this to work on. Okay, welcome in.
That makes sense to me. Last question is, I understand, okay, so interesting, this is here, good. How do you get from there to the self-compassion? Maybe that's just obvious.
How do you get from where to where?
From noticing, oh, there's this discomfort, there's this thing pushing back against me, to this moment of like, oh, I'm going to practice self-compassion here. Are you already doing that just by saying, oh, good, to this situation?
Well, it has to come. You have to find it. It doesn't happen, you don't get wound up. And then the self compassion happens. I think the fundamental point here is that you have to have confidence. I think Coben talked about this. You have to have confidence in the fact that you are Buddha. That's where it all starts. If there's any parallel to what in Christian tradition we call faith, it's confidence in the fact that you are a fully realized human being. You've just forgotten it. And so you sit and bring that up. That's why we meditate, to get rid of all that other stuff that is kind of helping you to forget. You get back in touch with that. So it's a confidence that compassion is there. It's just a question of finding it. And so you sit and you are open and spacious and it arises. You have to have confidence in that. Mm-hmm. That's best I can do.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Did you have?
I had read, there was another Buddhist teacher who was talking about waking up with all of our flaws. There's something about the way you spoke in your talk. I just liked it. It made me want to ask about that. Sometimes I think I know what that means, and other times I don't.
Waking up with all our flaws,
our quirks, our unique challenges, I guess.
I try not, and this is hard, I try not to think about or to call things flaws. I think that, for me, is a kind of leftover from a Judeo-Christian tradition. And again, this is just me talking. Because we embedded in our psyches is this tradition of somehow there's something wrong with us. We have flaws. We've sinned. You know, there's this original sin. And that there's something wrong with us, so we have to be saved. You know, we have to overcome, and all the self-improvement stuff out there. You know, we have to become perfect. But what if we did away with the word flaw? Flaw, that's a kind of a funny word too, flaw. Flaw. It sort of sounds like what it is, flaw.
I felt that when I asked the question, by the way.
Yeah, it's a flaw. It's something wrong with me. And this is a profound thing that we all walk around with. There's just something wrong with me. And I've got to be saved. I've got to somehow fix this. I think in Buddhist practice, perhaps instead of speaking about I'm flawed, what if we simply said I'm human? I'm human, and I've got all this wonderful stuff, you know? There's nothing flawed about it. It's just being human. And if I'm going to confess anything, I'm not going to confess my sins, I'm going to confess my humanity, you know? And this is a practice. Because we live in a culture which is always pointing to things that are not quite right about you. Because then you need to get the newest iPad or the newest set of the designer jean that has the new whatever it is. Look up in the Hamacher Schlemmer catalog. You're not really with it until you have a 6 foot high gumball machine.
Yeah.
Right?
That's in the residence building. Clearly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's one of the ways Jikoji seems to be changing. So this is a practice to be I am perfectly human, and what I need to discover is that I need to discover that what I thought was flawed is perfect as it is. And so that takes a whole chunk of suffering out of the picture, because we're not racing around chasing after ways to fix ourselves. Can we just accept that everything that arises within us is exactly what needs to arise as human beings, because that's who we are, and that's what human beings do and experience.
Suzuki Roshi said, you're perfect just as you are, but you could use a little work.
You can use a little improvement, yeah. Well, the improvement is to recognize that you are perfect just the way you are. So not to believe your thoughts, not to believe your assessments, but to find, and again, this goes back to the sense of confidence. It all begins there, that when you sit down, you have the confidence that, and there's no way to justify that confidence. It just has to be there. And if you could justify it, it wouldn't be confidence. It wouldn't be trust. You'd have good reasons for it. And that's why we need each other. And we need to help each other, support each other in this practice. That's why Sangha is so important, because there are so many pressures that are pushing us in different direction, that there is something wrong with us, that we are flawed individuals, that, you know, we need to fix that, we need to fix ourselves up in some way.
I just have a quick question. So you mentioned coming to that place of, you know, having all these different plates that were spinning, and then it all crashes down. And where's that line between just watching the plates crash, and then where you get the idea to maybe pick up one of those plates and either fix it or start spinning different plates? Like, you know, like, obviously you're not saying just sit there and look at the how broken the plates are. Or are you?
That's a good beginning. Because this is what our practice is. That's what meditation is about. That we make a space for ourselves, as artificial as it seems to be, at least in its obviousness. We make a place for ourselves to actually look at those plates, watch them fall, have a sense of what stories we're telling around them, what are the sensations, the physical and emotional sensations that are happening around those falling plates, and then to be able to see clearly which plate needs to be picked up, which plate needs to be repaired, which plate needs to be that wasn't even my plate. Somebody threw that plate into my space. But that's what our practice, that's what meditation helps us to do. And as soon as we practice more and more, getting clear, then when we're actually within a situation in which the plates are flying all over the place and crashing into people and to walls, and we can still see clearly. We can, the pause that refreshes, you know, we can take a breath, and because we have that meditation practice deeply embedded in us, we can right then and there, because we have our cushion with us, we have our cushion inside of us, we can see through, okay, that plate needs to go there, this plate needs to go there. And maybe we're wrong. we're wrong. We're not flawed. We just made a mistake. And we have another opportunity. The door will open again, and we will have another opportunity to watch those plates flying around. It's what makes life vital. You know, we're not contented cows just sitting. Would be nice, like the rabbit says, would be nice to just have a nice little beautiful bell around our necks, and, you know, but even cows suffer. I mean, it's always, if only I was this or that or the other thing, or I didn't have any plates, you know, flying around. So this is the practice, is to get to see more and more clearly, to have more and more open, spacious mind, so that we're not reactive, we're not just reacting to things.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.